This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. You know, all over the country, there's renewed interest in foodways, like where does our food come from and how does the food we consume reflect our cultural heritage? And what do our meals say about who we are and where we come from and trying to maintain good nutrition with a culinary identity? All those questions today. My guest, Penelope Easton, says these questions are not new. Her mantra is, "He who rejects my food rejects me." Now at the age of 91, she's sharing her story of her exploration of native foods of Alaska when it was just a territory. The book is called Learning to Like Muktuk. It traces her work as a dietitian in remote parts of the Alaskan Territory in the late 1940s and 50s. In the early 50s, Penelope Easton joins me now. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Good morning.
Nice to have you. Tell you, you grew up in Vermont, right?
Vermont, that's right. So, I'm still a Vermonter, even though I have only a cemetery plot up there.
Not much left there. But then, so what took you to Alaska?
I was hired to be a dietary consultant to work with the small hospitals, they were all small, and the institutions where the children were, the orphanages, because of the scourges of tuberculosis and measles. Alaska had always been subject to scourges from different kinds of diseases that white men brought them because they had no natural immunity to this. But these two, particularly the measles, had wiped out the young people in the villages, the hunters and the gatherers. And so there were all these orphans that had to be taken care of. And these children's homes took them in even when they didn't have room for them. And primarily the children's homes were run by missions, or maybe there were individual families that moved and so forth. But everywhere there were children that would have been years before taken care of by their extended families and the communities in which they lived.
So already your mission really is to kind of cope with the disruption.
That's right.
And see
what we could do about delivery of food and attention to what the children had known. And that's, of course, what surprised me was that very little attention, in fact, actual derision, was there against the native foodways. And these thousands of years, they had found out that rose hips had vitamin C. Of course, they didn't know it was vitamin C, but they knew that it was good for them and kept them from getting scurvy, actually, in the winter. And these kinds of things, the white men that went there did not respect, and some of them, to their dismay, actually had illness. One of the things is that the polar bear liver has enough vitamin A, and vitamin A is toxic and fat soluble, has enough vitamin A to be poisonous. And the explorers wouldn't pay any attention to the natives who said, "Don't eat that." Now, they ate livers from other things because it was very important. And so then they ate it anyway because it was there, and then they had illness. And I don't know that the explorers died, but other people did die from it, yeah.
So how did you learn this? I mean, it's interesting because you've got an education in public health nutrition, so you know something about nutrition, right? And you're going to go up there and you're going to bring all your education. So, and you write about this in your book, these first experiences of this, experiencing this derision. How is it expressed? How did you hear it?
Well, they would not give any credence to the preservation methods. Mm. These sophisticated, thousands of years, they had found out that if they took a wheel, I'm talking to the whale, that's muktuk, but I'm talking about seal. If they took a seal carcass and turned it inside out and clipped off the flippers, that they could keep meat and vegetables or greens and berries by pouring seal oil over them and keeping them cool. And they would feed people all winter. But of course, later on they did do, and they did freezing also in the cold permafrost refrigerators that they dug.
Right. So what were they feeding? So what were they feeding these kids in the hospitals and the orphanages?
Well, they were white men's food, really. They had soups and stews and cereals, and bread was introduced, of course. And many times they had some local meat, occasionally, in some of the villages, meat was given to the children's home, but primarily they had food shipped in a horrible bureaucratic mess. In the hospitals, this Alaska Native Service hospitals, a nurse, usually, who knew nothing about ordering food, ordered food to come in 18 months later on a barge. And so the people were dealing with the food that had been ordered 18 months before what they had. And I went to one children's home, one hospital, I mean, Kanakanak, and they'd had almost no food left, and they should have had 300 servings, 300 daily servings for everyone. They had a week's left of eggs. The peanut butter was rancid. Can you imagine peanut butter getting rancid? They were really desperate. Now, they could fly in food, but it was terribly expensive, and the people in Juneau did not relish doing that. So that was the worst food crisis I hit, but they were all problems. And so I was trying to help. I was hired to help them order food and to teach people how to cook it and to also distribute it through the rest of the time until the barge came.
Well, I've got to take a step back now because we're talking about 1948. Alaska is a territory. It is a wild, wild place. And you're a young woman about to make a journey from, okay, a cold and snowy place, Vermont, but it's not Alaska. What were you thinking?
I went because I was poor. I had been in the service and for 2 years, and actually a third year as an intern ahead of that. And so I had been in Karachi, which was then India, and had seen food ways all over the world, and of course grew up during the Depression in Vermont. So I was prepared for making do and using the local produce. I knew how to run small hospitals. I'd done that. I'd had good training on what we knew about nutrition at the time. But I didn't want cold weather. And I was being interviewed or contacted by the Maui Health Department in Hawaii. And I thought, oh, this is going to be warm and wonderful. But they offered me almost $100 a week to go to Alaska. I went.
Pretty good money back then.
Yes, very good money.
So was that you were just not going to do any of the 48 states, only territories? That was it.
Well, that's all it was being offered at the moment.
$100 a week, which is good money. In fact, you were even able to bring your mother up on trips to visit your aunt.
I got promoted to over, a little bit over 100 by the second year.
Wow. Yeah. So that's pretty good. So now you do get there. You've been to India. You've been around a little bit, and you've had experience using local food ways. What was your experience in trying to convince these operators, hospital and orphanage operators, that there was some wisdom in local foodways?
I'm sorry.
What was your experience when you tried to tell them, look, these folks have been here for millennia eating what they ate. It must have been working. Can't we try to get some of this into the hospital?
I didn't do that, really. What I tried to do was, particularly when there were patients in the hospital, I'm really answering the same question in a way. The patients were flown all over the territory. Little tiny children were thrust into our arms to take to another hospital 5,000 miles away, perhaps. And these children and young people and older people were going home to their villages, particularly in the Arctic. The doctors and the nurses didn't know what to tell them to eat because they didn't know anything about the local. And there were lots of different locals. So we did do a Food Resources of Alaska, a little pamphlet, and it took us 19 different descriptions because the food ways were so different in all these villages. And remember, there were still only 100,000 people in Alaska at that time, and 50,000 of them were white people. So what I did was to try to tell them how to respect what they would get when they got home. And the native people had started to hide their food ways and their foods and their storages from everybody visiting, even medical personnel. Now, they trusted me for some reason, and I learned that if you dipped a needlefish, which is like the vertebrae sticking out of a fish, into a seal oil and let it slide head first down your throat, it didn't scratch your esophagus. They let me see that. I didn't do it. I will admit that. And, of course, that's the whole theme of the book. I learned to like muktuk, and I wanted to teach other people to like what these thousands of years of exploration had shown were good foods. Now, they also knew about what ones were poison, and there were poison foods, of course, particularly poison plants. And that lore was being lost as well because the elders were dying too, and the elders were the sources of all the knowledge and the myths. And this was done in stories and dances. And the white people that had come in, I think we should tell you about Sheldon Jackson. Sheldon Jackson was the first educator in the health department full time. And he had come, he was a minister, and he had come from the western United States where they wanted to put all the children into reservations and to remove them from their native ways. And he insisted. Now, of course, he was still alive when I was there, but he wasn't in office. But people followed his, that anything to do with their native heritage was a drawback for these youngsters to live in the 20th century. And so they removed them from their homes. They gave them good names like George and Walter and John, maybe Frank, I don't know, and Nancy. And they wouldn't let them speak their native language anywhere to play their native games, and therefore they couldn't talk to their elders. So the loss of information about the beauty and the exquisite, sophisticated methods of dealing with food was being lost. And some of it has never been regained.
Wait, I have to get you to tell me what muktuk is, of course.
Okay. Well, muktuk is the skin of the whale. There's supposed to be a seal muktuk, but I never ran into it. So we'll leave it with the whale. The skin of the whale with small bits of the flesh attached. And you eat it either hot or cold. And it is a great delicacy. I don't have any samples here, thank goodness, because it's hard to transport. And I couldn't afford it anyway. I did learn to like it. When I first had it, I thought that it tasted like lard on rubber tires. But since I'd never eaten rubber tires, I don't know whether that was very apt or not. But as you said in the beginning, I would not reject anything offered me in hospitality. And my standard was I had eaten a raw oyster. You know how slimy those raw oysters are? You know, muktuk is nothing compared to raw oysters. And so I did eat everything, and I wanted to teach other people too, and I wanted to help prepare these people to go back to their villages and go to their food customs.
I'm going to stick with muktuk for just a second. Is it kind of chew? I mean, do you just keep chewing it like gum, or do you ultimately swallow it?
Yes, you swallow it. Okay, yeah, so the skin is, in fact, Janelle Smith, who was a graduate student and had me, former graduate student, and had me come up four times after I was there for these first 2 years. She said it tasted like raw carrots. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it did, but it's crunchy. Yes, you can chew it.
So why do you think you said that you were being led into some of these secrets? In the first place, why do you think that Native peoples were keeping these secrets?
Well, because people laughed at them and called them barbarian and savages. And the children were considered savages, you know. And, of course, their religious beliefs were also questioned.
Right.
Their spiritual beliefs. And they had strong spiritual backgrounds, varying some from tribe to tribe.
Now, you had quite an experience in Wasilla, didn't
you? You found about Wasilla? All these people who have read the book, and there are a lot of them, no one ever picked up about Wasilla, Alaska, and here you've done it, Frank. Well, back at when I first went to Anchorage, there was a little village called Wasilla nearby. and also Palmer and so forth. And the people from Wasilla had a school of about 125 children, and they wanted to have a school lunch program, a federal school lunch program. They contacted the health department, and they included me. I was attached to them at the time, and said, we want to have a school lunchroom. And we examined. They had nothing but an attic with wooden stairs, wooden ladder, not even stairs, to climb up into this attic. And we said, you can't have a lunchroom here. You've got nothing but an attic and a ladder. 2 years later, I went back and did an official inspection of the Wasilla School lunchroom. The town and the people, of course, of the school had built this lovely lunchroom with a dining room and a kitchen, and they fed about 90 children a day. Already you could see how much better the children looked. And, of course, that was in the springtime, and I guess actually that was in the fall. Mm-hmm. But they looked better, and they were so proud of it.
We are teaching you how to like Muktuk today on The State of Things. Author Penelope Easton is here telling us about her explorations of territorial Alaska back in the late 40s and early 50s, discovering native foodways as a dietitian. Was Sarah Palin the mayor at the time? No, not at the time.
No.
I think they've since wiped out all federal programs up there, owing to, perhaps.
I don't think she even knew about the school lunch program.
You have gone back since.
Yeah, I went back four times between 1996 and 2005 on research projects about nutrition, some with the Women, Infants, and Children's programs. And they were on grants that Janelle Smith was in charge of. And then we also did with those were the young mothers of the territory all over. We did five different regions and five different areas. And then I also went back when we studied the elders in different villages as well.
Actually, you had the advantage there on your last trip, didn't you?
Yes, I was 73 when she was brave enough to put me on her team, and they treated me like an elder. Now, being an elder is not just being old. You're supposed to have some sort of valuable knowledge for the tribe, and they considered my knowledge was valuable, I guess. I was really humbled by this. They would let me sit in their council meetings. The rest of the group could come, but they had to sit off, and they had no say. I didn't talk, but I could have. And it was a wonderful. That was how only time I really got to know the village people, the native people, because when I was there the first time, they were either patients or workers or maybe community people in classes.
Did you get a sense on your last visit that there is more respect now for native foodways?
Yes, much more.
Have many been maintained, or have we lost too many?
Yes, some of them have been maintained, and of course they've been revised with freezers and that sort of thing. But they still dry the salmon on, mm-hmm. you know, in that kind of way. They haven't done what I think they should do is commercialize these wonderful things. I wanted to buy rosehip tea bags to serve. That rosehip tea bags came from Australia. And they have all these little museums with stores. Why aren't they having the million people who visit Alaska every year buying Alaska rosehip tea?
Sounds like you got to make one more trip.
Well, I don't know if the Chamber of Commerce is going to ask me.
Well, we're going to ask you back. There is far too little time. There is far more to tell. So I guess we're going to have to ask you back, Penelope. But thank you for spending this time. Penelope Easton, the author of Learning to Like Muktuk. She's going to be speaking at McIntyre Books in Pittsburgh February 15th. Going to teach a class on Alaskan foods at Southern Season Cooking School in Chapel Hill in April. All those details are at our website, stateofthings.org. Also, check out our Facebook page. Just ahead, the music of Mary Johnson Rockers and The Spark. Stay tuned.